This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 6, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Bush accuses terrorists of seeking nuclear weapons as U.S. bombs of choice come under close inspection. Millions of voters across the U.S. go to the polls to elect mayors and governors. The New York mayoral race is a cliffhanger. And 10 hunger strikers are dead in Istanbul. A mass suicide or a police massacre? We'll have a report. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today in Northern Ireland, David Trimble has been re-elected First Minister, avoiding another political blow-up.
We look forward to delivering to you the quality of administration which you have every right to expect. We understand those who have got their concerns about this process and indeed who will be appalled at the scenes that they can hear at the moment. I'm well aware of the concerns that many people have and the difficulties that we have had.
Last week, members of his own voting bloc voted against him, threatening to collapse the already unsteady Home Rule. But today, the Protestant bloc approved him by a simple majority of 31 to 29. Catholics endorsed him unanimously. Peace in the region is still in doubt, as the Irish Republican Army and the British government have so far only promised to disarm. And voters in five U.S. cities are voting today on ballot measures that will impact the local gay and lesbian communities. In Houston, voters will decide whether or not the city should ever adopt domestic partnership benefits. Grant Martin is the campaign coordinator for those opposed to Proposition 2.
Clearly, I mean, what the election really is, it's just a big sort of symbolic vote, up or down vote on gay people. It's like, do we want, you know, gay people to feel at home in our city? And it's a very, very, very close election. I mean, the polls have been very close. I don't know which way it's going to turn out. I feel good about our campaign, but I don't feel good enough to predict.
Two cities in Michigan are considering legislation that would prohibit the city councils from enacting laws that would ban discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. John Wilkerson is with the group Kalamazoo Against Discrimination.
If you get out the message, you tell them what it's about, you tell them it's about discrimination, you tell them why it's on the ballot, they say, you know, we don't want this in Kalamazoo, we don't want this in any city. And, you know, Kalamazoo has become a great city in Western Michigan simply because of its diversity and acceptance of everybody. If Traverse City educates voters, they're going to be able to put up a good fight and hopefully win. You know, Traverse City doesn't want this amendment or proposal, just like Kalamazoo doesn't want this proposal.
And in two separate measures, voters in Miami Beach will decide whether or not to grant domestic partnership benefits to unmarried partners. One would grant health benefits to city workers. The other would give pension benefits only to the domestic partners of firefighters and police officers. A woman who was the victim of domestic abuse and thrown out of her apartment on a nonviolent clause has won her case. Denise Kowalczyk reports from Portland, Oregon.
The government, the ACLU, and three other legal organizations had filed a lawsuit on behalf of Tiffany Alvera, who they say was evicted from her apartment because of a fight with her husband, even though she was the victim. The plaintiffs charged that the owner's policy of evicting the entire household after any incident of domestic violence constituted sex discrimination against Alvera, who was thrown out of her government-subsidized apartment in 1999. Under the consent decree, CBM Group, based in Auburn, California, will not attempt to evict domestic violence victims from any of its more than 100 housing developments. One lawyer called the decree, filed last week in U.S. District Court, a resounding victory for battered individuals. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Denise Kowalczyk.
And finally, Congress discussed clamping down on the availability of biological agents, whether being used for research or other activities. Gareth Schweitzer reports from the Capitol.
Scientists and representatives from the FBI and Department of Justice have recommended that Congress institute a system of background checks for researchers who could have access to harmful biological agents. In addition, senators were told today that a better system to track what biological agents were possessed by various laboratories was an important step in limiting any access terrorist organizations may have to dangerous samples. Ronald Atlas, national president of the American Society of Microbiology, testified in support of these measures.
These agents should be restricted to legitimate facilities and the workers there must be pursuing research or diagnostic activities that are in for the public good.
Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced legislation today that would prevent labs or individuals from working with certain biological agents unless certified to do so by the Department of Health and Human Services. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The United States has confirmed it is using 15,000-pound bombs against Afghanistan. These so-called daily cutters are some of the most devastating weapons in the U.S. arsenal, short of nuclear weapons. This, as President George W. Bush addressed a summit of Central and European leaders in Warsaw, Poland. In his address, Bush accused the Al-Qaeda network of attempting to acquire nuclear weapons. Jeremy Scahill has more on the developments.
The Bush administration has said its so-called war on terror will resemble the Cold War. And today, President Bush pushed that message at a summit of Central and European heads of state in Warsaw, Poland. Many of these countries were once considered frontline states in the Cold War. Now they have become frontline states in Washington's push for harsh policies of corporate globalization and devastating economic reforms. Speaking via satellite from the White House, President Bush gave a preview of what he plans on telling the United Nations General Assembly this weekend. Bush issued a warning to countries around the world.
I will set out my vision of our common responsibilities in the war on terror. I will put every nation on notice that these duties involve more than sympathy or words. No nation can be neutral in this conflict.
Almost like clockwork, as Bush was speaking, German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder announced his government was making nearly 4,000 of its troops available for Washington's war. Schroeder said the move was in direct response to a request from the Bush administration. Germany's offer is indeed historic, as it could lead to that nation's widest-ranging military engagement since the Nazi era. The deployment has not been approved by the parliament, and Chancellor Schroeder could face opposition from members of his ruling coalition. His key coalition partner, the German Green Party, has called for an end to the attacks on Afghanistan, and today Schroeder tried to downplay the role the German troops will play.
It's important to underline that the United States have not requested any participation in air attacks or ground troops within Afghanistan.
The Pentagon has confirmed it has begun dropping devastating 15,000-pound bombs on Afghanistan. These so-called daisy cutters are the size of a small car, and they leave a fiery crater the size of 7 football fields when they detonate. Still, the Northern Alliance militia today called for even heavier attacks on the country they claim to be fighting to liberate. Alliance spokesperson Abdullah Abdullah.
We don't need more time. We are in the good level of preparation, military preparation in all fields, in all fronts. Then it is the matter of decisions made in the high authorities where and when to go.
The Taliban claimed today its forces had shot down another U.S. helicopter, killing 4 American soldiers. The Pentagon denies the reports. Neither version can be independently confirmed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
Talks continue in Rome this week as members of the Northern Alliance come to meet with exiled Afghan King Zahir Shah. Little is known about the closed-door negotiations, but as Fariba Nawa reports from Islamabad, Pakistan, not a single woman has been invited to participate in the talks.
Women, who make up 55% of Afghanistan's population, are demanding to be heard and included in a post-Taliban government. Afghan women leaders say they have been ignored in ex-King Mohammad Zahir Shah's representative government plans, but they say that is not for lack of trying.
We're trying to be part of it because the important issue for us is the future of Afghan people, and as a political organization, we have to play a role.
A member from the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, better known as RAWA, said they are lobbying to be part of the Loya Jirga, or Grand Assembly, which will decide the fate of Afghanistan's future government. RAWA members keep their identity secret because the Taliban have issued an edict to kill them for running homeschools and lobbying against the militia.
Today, when we talk about literacy, about women's rights, of women's political works, that our women should be involved in all aspects of social and political realm, that women can be counted as human beings, and they're not. That's a revolution. this dialogue we have before us has to bring change, a revolution.
Afghan women have organized a workshop scheduled Wednesday in Peshawar, where 700,000 Afghan refugees live. About 60 women have been invited to discuss solutions for peace. And from December 4th to the 6th, Afghan women from all over the world, including Afghanistan, will gather in Brussels, Belgium, for a Women's Peace Summit. At the summit, women will present a list of potential women leaders who should be included in the assembly and outline their political platform. Men involved in the Rome peace process say they definitely plan to include women in the assembly, but they are still searching for potential members to represent both genders and all ethnicities in the country. They say no one has been named as a member yet. But women argue that they deserve to be included in the planning process, too. Afghan women leaders in Pakistan were particularly upset when women were excluded from a peace conference 2 weeks ago in Peshawar. Pir Sayyid Ahmed Gailani, an advisor and longtime supporter of exiled King Zahir Shah, invited 1,200 men representing all Afghan ethnicities and religious sects, but not one woman. In response to the criticism, Gailani said women were kept out for security reasons. Whether the efforts of these women will have any effect remains to be seen, but Afghan women's issues have been at the forefront of international discussion since hardline Taliban militia took control of 90% of Afghanistan. The Taliban forced women out of school and work and tried to keep them out of the public sphere altogether. Afghan women say players in Afghanistan's future, including the United States and the United Nations, use the oppression of Afghan women to further their agendas, but have done little to improve women's lives. But they also hope that these gatherings and their activism will finally make them decision makers in their nation's future. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Fariba Nawa in Islamabad.
Millions of voters are going to the polls today to elect mayors or governors from New York to Washington State. Seattle, Atlanta, Boston, Cleveland, Houston, and Pittsburgh are all electing mayors. But the race for Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's seat in New York City is the cliffhanger of them all. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Miranda Kennedy reports.
The contest for New York mayor between Democrat Mark Green and Republican Michael Bloomberg turned unexpectedly close in a race that has taken on national significance since September 11th.
My background in terms of creating jobs and managing and dealing different economic cycles and making choices is exactly what's right for the next 4 years for now.
Multi-billionaire Michael Bloomberg spent today campaigning alongside Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, whose support has bolstered Bloomberg's campaign. Bloomberg produced $23.5 million worth of TV, radio, and print ads since May. One consultant has received more than $700,000 since joining the campaign in February.
Money talks.
Mark Green.
My opponent, Mike Bloomberg, has been a successful businessman in the last 12 years, making billions of dollars. In the last 12 years, I've been a citywide official making policy for seniors, children, and families.
Recently, Bloomberg's sordid history of three sexual harassment lawsuits and gender discrimination charges have emerged in the press, though Bloomberg's company spokesperson insists he has zero tolerance for harassment or rape. Democrat Mark Green has gone on the offensive about Bloomberg's past in recent weeks, as his lead over his opponent narrowed. But as the day draws to a close, many believe Green will be on the losing side of the ballot. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Miranda Kennedy in New York.
Citizens in Cincinnati, Ohio, are deciding between two former TV anchors as their next mayor, one an African-American political novice and the other a white political veteran, each trying to become the first directly elected mayor in 76 years in a city torn by racial division. Today's election came as the city was still trying to cope with the racial unrest that erupted after a white police officer fatally shot an unarmed black man in April. The shooting touched off 3 nights of riots in which dozens of people were injured and more than 800 were arrested. There are no Republicans in this race. Democratic incumbent Charles Lucan has structured the debate around his experience. Political neophyte Curtis Fuller, a registered Democrat running his first political race as a third-party candidate, says what Cincinnati needs is a change in leadership and a mayor that can bring the racially polarized city together. Damon Lynch is minister of the New Prospect Baptist Church in Cincinnati. He spoke with us about the candidates and their tactics.
Before September 11th, Cincinnati was ground zero for the nation as it erupted in violence following police misconduct. So if there's a strong African-American turnout, Curtis Fuller may be the first directly elected mayor in Cincinnati in 76 years. If the African-American community does not turn out, then we could well have Charlie Lucan as our mayor for the next 4 years.
So it sounds like you're saying this campaign is basically going to be, or this election is going to be determined along racial lines.
It is. And right now, the history and the reality of Cincinnati, everything is determined around racial lines. We've just had three police officers who were found not guilty in court for taking the lives of unarmed citizens. White officers, black citizens, and there is a serious racial divide right now that I personally don't believe Charlie Lucan can bridge, and that Curtis Fuller would be a better person to deal with that serious issue in Cincinnati.
Well, if you say it's going to come down to racial lines and the African-American community is 43%, that's clearly not a majority. I mean, is it just that simple in your opinion?
Well, it's not a majority, but there are always people on both sides who vote for what's right. There are always people, white Americans, who vote for the better candidate. So while we are a clearly divided community, there are people who will do the right thing, and you have to count on people of goodwill to do the right thing.
Damon Lynch, minister of the New Prospect Baptist Church in Cincinnati. Governor's seats are up for grabs in Virginia, New Jersey, and Maine. In the Old Dominion, two conservatives, both supporting the death penalty, parole, abolition, and gun rights, are battling it out, with the Democrat Mark Warner carrying a slight lead over the GOP's Mark Early. In New Jersey, Democrat Jim McGreevy is leading Republican Brett Shundler by a sizable margin. And in Maine, voters are primarily focused on bond issues. But in Portland, there's also a two-page resolution on the wisdom of state-funded universal health care, and campaigners on both sides of the issue hope the vote will foretell the future of universal health care in Maine. Jeannie Barron reports.
Driving along Portland's tree-lined streets, the debate is cast by competing signs. Blue ones that read, "Vote Yes for Universal Health Care," are lined up beside white signs that read, "Vote No on higher taxes and fewer choices." The ballot question is non-binding, but the debate over the question is still heated. Maine's largest insurance company has underwritten a campaign to defeat the resolution, and so far, it's spent almost $400,000, primarily on television advertising. The ballot question is long and contains numerous statements about the necessity of a publicly funded trust for health insurance, similar to Social Security. Dr. Duncan White is an organizer for the Yes Camp. He says voters will be considering a moral question.
The first point is that health care is an essential safeguard of human life and dignity, and there is an obligation for society to ensure that every person be able to realize that right.
Proponents like Wright have about $10,000 to spend, a fraction compared to their opponents. About 13% of Portland residents are uninsured, and many with insurance are facing double-digit rate increases this year. In the past, the state legislature has considered several bills on universal health care. None has passed, and Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield is spending a lot of money to make sure the same thing happens this year. Company spokesperson Bill Cohen says Anthem is dedicated to defeating the ballot question in the interests of maintaining a competitive insurance market for consumers.
Anthem and the other insurance companies in Maine on this issue understand how the complexity of what is going on and have to protect our members and their choice.
Both sides agree that health care costs are too high and that everyone should have access to care when they need it. But the Yes Camp says that nearly every other industrialized nation has universal health coverage, and in those countries, public health is better and health care costs are cheaper. According to a recent report by the World Health Organization, the United States healthcare system ranks number one for expenditures and number 37th for performance, surpassed by countries like Morocco, Spain, and Singapore. Howard Buckley is the president of Portland's Mercy Hospital and a supporter of the resolution. He dismisses critics of universal health care systems, like the one in Canada.
Sure, Canada has some stories about where maybe the system has failed them, but there are a million stories down here where the system has failed our people. And basically, the people I would run into seem to be very satisfied.
But the No campaign says a government-run health insurance program would be forced to ration care to control costs at the price of developing technology and innovative treatments. John Carroll is a Portland oncologist, and he's working hard to defeat the idea of a single-payer healthcare system. He says Americans do and should expect their health system to provide the best care there is when facing a serious illness. And he says a no vote from Portland is the right signal to send to the state legislature this winter.
I hope it will send a message to legislators that we need to continue to work to correct the system, but that particular solution will not work in the United States. It does not fit the character of the people of this country, neither does it fit the character of the economic system of the country.
A recently conducted statewide poll found that 55% of those responding support the creation of a universal health care system, while about 30% oppose it. But the margin is believed to be much closer in southern Maine. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeannie Barron in Portland, Maine.
A deadly police raid on a group of hunger strikers in Istanbul last night left 4 people dead. Hundreds of Turkey's elite special forces unit, akin to those fighting alongside the U.S. anti-terrorism allies in Afghanistan, attacked a house harboring a number of people, including 10 hunger strikers. The protesters were bringing attention to Turkish prison conditions. Free Speech Radio News correspondent James Smoot is in Istanbul, where he files this report of what can best be described as a massacre.
The raid involved an estimated 2,000 police, including members of elite anti-terrorism squads similar to those dispatched last week into Afghanistan. More than a dozen people were injured, with one, Haka Shimshek, thought to be in critical condition. Shimshek, one of the hunger strikers, was shot in the head and is not expected to survive. Beginning at 2:30 Monday afternoon, police sealed off the shantytown neighborhood of Armutlu and cut off electricity and telephone services. According to eyewitnesses, police surrounded the house and set it on fire, then assaulted it with tanks and armored cars. 14 people were in the building at the time, 10 of them grotesquely weakened from a 6-month fast. The 4 killed in the assault died of burns or smoke inhalation. Sources at the Turkish Human Rights Association say there is no count of those arrested in the operation. Rights advocates and lawyers have been denied access to those in hospital and in police custody. But the total is likely to be more than 100, as police arrested everyone who tried to enter the area after the siege began. Police say they staged the raid to rescue hunger strikers from certain death, but sources at the Human Rights Association said that if that was the true intention of the raid, it did not require such overwhelming force. Most likely the aim of the raid was to crush the hunger strike and remove an embarrassing reminder of Turkey's appalling human rights record. The hunger strike has gone on for over a year, and 41 people have died to date. At issue is a government policy to move prisoners from old-style ward prisons, prisons with smaller cells. Prison activists object to this, as in the smaller cells, prisoners will be more vulnerable to abuse by guards. The regime for the new prisons will keep inmates under lockdown as well. No association of any kind will be allowed. Human rights authorities said this is psychological torture, but the Turkish Ministry of Justice declares the isolation regime is essential to keep prisoners from spreading revolutionary propaganda. There are at least 6,000 political prisoners in Turkey. Under the ward-style system, prisons became the center for recruitment and organization for revolutionary organizations. Some former political inmates called the prisons universities for revolution. More than 200 people are still on hunger strike, and with dozens having prolonged their fast for more than 6 months, more deaths are imminent. For Free Speech Radio News, this is James Smoot in Istanbul.
Tens of thousands of people from across India converged on the capital, New Delhi, today to show their opposition to the World Trade Organization and its controversial economic policies. The massive demonstration serves as a prelude to what's in store for the WTO summit in Doha, which kicks off in 3 days. Today's rally is being described as one of the biggest shows of force by the Indian left in recent history. It was called by 19 groups from people's movements to secular political parties. Sputnik Kalambi reports from Delhi.
They came from north, south, east and west, farmers, workers, men and women from the private and public sectors, to push forward one message: turn around, no more round. This in reference to the upcoming WTO meeting in Doha. The crowd was 40,000 strong and roared in agreement as speaker after speaker denounced the Indian government's supine acceptance of the diktat of the world's big powers and corporations. Atal Bihari Vajpayee, wake up, they chanted. Vajpayee, quit your seat. A new chapter in the struggle against economic globalization seems to have been opened today. World-renowned activist Vandana Shiva says today's mass rally was a signal to the government that the people of India will not accept the sellout of their country.
The public, the social movements, and the political parties
are going to fight the issue of WTO through domestic politics. And to basically remind them that the pressures they feel and experience from a visit by Zolik, the U.S. trade representative, or the pressure from all the corporations, the Cargill in the food front, Monsanto on the BT cotton and seed front, the Vivendi's on the waterfront, that pressure has to be counterbalanced now by the pressure of an electoral process and the pressure of movements within the country to defend the rights of people to their natural resources, to their livelihoods, and to their democratic rights to function in a free economy.
Another famous activist who addressed the rally was Medha Patkar, who's been campaigning against big dams that threaten to displace thousands of people. She's also part of the National Alliance of People's Movements. Today's protest was unprecedented, she says, because it was the first time political parties have joined with people's movements on a common platform.
The farmers have to join hands with the government servants or the other workers in the factories and industries. All of them face displacement. All of them face deprivation. They have no place in the market, whether it is for human resource or for the natural produce.
Equally unprecedented was the participation of people representing the managerial and officer class. Ashok Rao, Secretary General of the National Confederation of Central and Public Sector Undertakings.
Normally, people who are in the managerial officer category do not join such rallies. But the issue is such that we felt the need to join this rally because many of the multilateral agreements that are being made in the WTO are going to definitely affect the entire industrial situation in this country, whether it is TRIPS, whether it is multilateral agreement on investments and so on and so forth. Our serious concern is that at the end of this process, India is going to become much, much weaker.
The WTO has hardly been an issue with leaders of the current government who've been crying themselves hoarse over the need to fight terrorism. But terrorism, says Medha Patkar, is also economic, and it's essential to see through the false divisions being touted both by Osama bin Laden and George Bush.
The warfare that's on really is between those who own the money and market capital on one hand and the natural and human resource capital on the other. That's how I see it. And all of these people, whether the owners of the oil companies or the rulers of the large so-called democracies, which are arrogant and even autocratic. On the other side are the common people across the nation-state boundaries. And they are not only in the Indian subcontinent, but also in the so-called developed nations, because they are also fighting Bush in their own way.
It was at the Seattle round that Vandana Shiva described the WTO as the world's terrorist organization. Terrorism everywhere, she says, is closely related to policies that rob people of economic security and political sovereignty. In Punjab and Kashmir, as in Oklahoma or New York.
Globalization is creating conditions of terrorism and the rise of terrorism. Anyone who tries to think they can deal with terrorism, a symptom, without dealing with the causes of the disease that caused that symptom, don't understand that you can't separate the disease and the symptom. And it's just one more example, in my view, of a very impoverished Cartesian mind, a militarized mind, that is the basis of brute rule in the world just now, which is behind saying you are either with us or against us. And I think Doha is very, very symbolic. It's happening in the part of the world where the biggest might of the biggest militaries is the context in which a so-called free trade treaty is going to be pushed even more on the people of the world.
Sputnik Kilambi in Delhi for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown.